warhead on top of a missile that can reach the United States, that's obviously a direct threat. Secondly, President Trump has a very different approach to North Korea than President Obama, who practiced what was called strategic patience, essentially trying to put pressure on North Korea and hoping it would come back to the negotiating table. But President Trump is really ratcheting up the pressure while still keeping open the possibility of negotiations.
Yeah, you have been in meetings with North Korean officials, I mean, as a scholar as recently as a few months ago. What window into their thinking can you give us in how they might be responding to President Trump's approach?
Well, when I met the North Koreans a few months ago, it was just after President Trump was elected. So no one really knew what his policies would be. And the North Koreans were saying they would wait and see. They would bide their time, keep their powder dry to see what the new administration's approach would be. As to their reaction to his new approach, I think we should not underestimate North Korea's resolve to resist pressure from the United States. From their perspective, they are a small country dealing with the world's only superpower, and to show any weakness is suicide, and that's what they believe. So they are going to react very toughly to what we're doing.
A lot of Americans wondering whether to be nervous right now, how nervous to be. Are there signs we can look for in days, weeks, months ahead that will tell us this is actually getting incredibly serious?
Well, there could be signs in the weeks and months ahead. One sign which most Americans won't see is North Korean preparations for war. I don't think we've seen any of that yet. Secondly, something we will see is that South Koreans may go to the supermarkets, empty the shelves in preparation for war. And third, we may see a lot of foreigners in South Korea heading for the airports to get out of the country.
Okay. Well, obviously a story we'll be following very closely. Joel Witt is a senior fellow at the U.S.-Korea Institute at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and a former State Department official. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Years ago, while living in Kentucky, I was in a car that rolled past a power plant. I asked if it was nuclear power, and the driver laughed. He said, no, any power other than coal would not be well received in Kentucky, which is a coal-producing state. That was a long time ago, and times change. Today, some big employers in Kentucky want power from renewable energy. They want renewable energy even as the Trump administration pushes to promote coal. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports on a coal state that is thinking about solar.
Kevin Butt's job is to find cleaner ways to power Toyota. This sprawling plant in central Kentucky is one of the hardest places to do that, but he's trying.
This is a new engine assembly line, and this has a tremendous amount of energy efficiency involved.
Butt points out enormous fans overhead, LED lights, a more efficient motor that slowly moves a circular conveyor belt. He says all these changes save millions.
I mean, what company doesn't want to reduce their energy bill?
That's the business case for going green. And in a lot of places around the country, solar and wind are now the cheapest energy option. But by 2050, Toyota wants all of its operations all around the world to be zero carbon.
Is that realistic?
I think it is.
Toyota's not alone in Kentucky. GM, Ford, Walmart, L'Oreal, and others have big goals to reduce emissions. Even the state's beloved bourbon makers are looking at renewables, which are scarce.
There's not enough renewable energy being manufactured right now for all of us to do what we say we want to do. I mean, it's just not there. You don't have that amount of power.
It's especially not there here in Kentucky, where nearly 90% of energy still comes from coal, where people like to say coal isn't just the economy, it's the culture.
We're a coal state. We're proud to be a coal state. We're sentimental about our attachment to coal.
Charles Snavely is Secretary of Kentucky's Energy and Environment Cabinet. Before this job, he spent 35 years in the coal industry. Snavely's working with companies, he calls them customers, to help develop renewable energy. But he says he struggles.
Does the growth of renewables come at the expense of coal? Is it a bigger pie, or is someone taking a slice of our pie?
Coal built this state's economy, he says, creating some of the cheapest power in the country.
We have industries in Kentucky that would not be here if we didn't have such low electricity rates.
But now more and more businesses want solar or wind, even if they're still not quite as cheap as the state's coal.
The future is renewables and the large corporations that want renewables.
Jim Gardner used to help regulate Kentucky's power companies. 2 years ago, he was struck when someone at Facebook told him businesses are even deciding where to expand based on where they can get renewable energy.
He made it seem like there was literally a list with a lot of states with big X's marked in so that Facebook and others were not looking because they were not going to be open to renewables.
The Public Service Commission, where Gardner worked, worried the state was missing out. It quietly issued an official statement.
It just sent a clear signal to people outside of the state.
It said, hey, if a big customer wants renewable energy, Kentucky's utilities can cut a special deal to provide it. That meant utilities had permission to offer renewable energy, but they still had to find a way to produce it.
This tract is about 60 acres.
David Cruz is showing me a gently rolling field with a duck pond. This field will soon be full of 32,000 solar panels.
It'll butt right up against the golf course.
East Kentucky Power Cooperative is doing this by popular demand from businesses. The utility has no plans to build another coal plant. Cruz says just because the new president does not want to limit carbon emissions doesn't mean the next one won't.
The seesawing of regulations when we're trying to make a 50-year investment, it will drive you crazy, and that wouldn't be good for our customer base.
So the utility is marketing its new solar panels, and if demand is strong enough, Cruz says they'll add more. Toyota isn't waiting for the next solar farm. Kevin Budd is getting creative about finding renewable energy now. He takes me down a rutted dirt road through towering brown hills. It's a landfill, and here and there, things stick up.
The black tube coming out, it's a methane capture well.
The methane is released as the trash here rots. Now, when it goes into the air, methane's a dirty greenhouse gas. But last year, Toyota set up a generator to turn it into clean electricity. The power is sent through an underground line.
Right up over that hill, then it follows the road, sort of, almost all the way to the plant.
Straight to the Toyota plant, 6 miles away, bypassing the local utility altogether. But says until Kentucky's utilities offer more renewable energy, Toyota will keep finding other ways to get it. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
And on this Monday morning, it is 8:18. You are listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up next, it's news live from NPR and WPR. Hear about a bill that Governor Scott Walker is set to sign into law today that would make a marijuana extract available. That story in a couple of minutes.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, come find out more about Stars and Stripes Honor Flight Program for Veterans on Saturday, April 29th from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. at the Ridgewood Care Center in Racine. Call 815-378-2256.
Arkansas traveler, Irish washerwoman, and devil's dream. WPR is proud to promote live music. For more information, go to wpr.org/events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The U.S. Supreme Court's newest justice begins hearing arguments this week in a number of cases, as NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Justice Neil Gorsuch actually takes his seat today and will hear oral arguments in 7 cases this week. The most prominent of those is a big church-state case. They've been waiting for a ninth justice because of a very real possibility that this case will turn on his vote.
Gorsuch was nominated by President Trump. He fills the vacancy left by the death of Justice Antonin Scalia more than a year ago. In California, students are returning to San Bernardino's North Park Elementary School today, a week after a special education teacher and student were shot to death. As Danielle Carson reports, new security measures are in place.
The front door will now be kept locked during school hours. Visitors have to be buzzed in. A camera is mounted at the front entrance so school officials can see who's at the door. No visitors are allowed in classrooms without a legitimate reason, like bringing a forgotten lunch. In that case, their driver's license will be scanned, printed, and worn like an ID badge.
About 30,000 runners are taking part in this morning's Boston Marathon. This is the 121st running of the race. Security is tight 4 years after a deadly bombing near the finish line of the race. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:20. I'm Maureen McCollum. Governor Scott Walker is set to sign into law a measure that would legalize possession of a marijuana extract used to treat seizures. The governor has scheduled a bill signing for today in Burlington. The Republican-controlled legislature approved a bill this session to make CBD oil legal with a doctor's certification. The oil does not produce a high. Parents of children who suffer seizures say it can ease symptoms. Walker said earlier he supported a narrowly crafted measure on medical marijuana. Authorities in Wisconsin chased nearly 800 leads before Joseph Jakubowski was arrested while camping on a farmer's property. Jakubowski was a fugitive authorities believed had a cache of stolen firearms, who had also made unspecified threats against schools. The 32-year-old was arrested last Friday on a farm near Reedstown. That's about 125 miles northwest of Janesville, where the manhunt began after authorities say Jakubowski broke into a gun store and sent a threatening manifesto to the White House. Rock County Sheriff Robert Spoden says the suspect was disheveled and surrendered without incident. Jakubowski made his first appearance Friday afternoon in Madison. He faces local and federal weapons charges. He will remain in custody, and his next court appearance is scheduled for next Tuesday. It should be partly cloudy across Wisconsin today. Highs will be in the lower to mid-50s, except in the lower to mid-40s near Lake Superior. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumber Liquidators, a proud sponsor of NPR, offering more than 400 styles, including hardwood, bamboo, laminate, and vinyl, with flooring specialists in hundreds of stores nationwide. More at lumberliquidators.com or 1-800-HARDWOOD. From Merrill Lynch, an affiliate of Bank of America, focused on each client's priorities. More at ml.com. Merrill Lynch makes available products and services offered by Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith Incorporated, a registered broker-dealer. And from 23andMe, a personalized genetic service dedicated to helping people understand what their 23 pairs of chromosomes can tell them about their health, traits, and ancestry. Learn more at 23andme.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green. Today in your health, untangling the mystery of why shoelaces come untied when you exercise.
I'd like to know the answer myself. But first, a tribe in northern Idaho is incorporating its culture into its fitness programs. It's an effort to tackle high rates of heart disease and obesity. The program is called Powwow Sweat. Northwest News Network's Emily Schwing reports.
The Coeur d'Alene tribe is known for two things, its hospitality and its powwow. The cultural celebration is one of the largest native gatherings in the nation. So the tribe borrowed from that tradition and created an exercise program based on powwow dancing. The tribe has released a workout DVD. The series includes a warm-up and breaks down moves for six dances typical at powwows, including the men's fancy dance.
Four basic steps and then into the hip move. One, two, three, four, hit.
The hip move involves lifting your knee up and then circling it out to the side, all while bouncing to the drum beat.
Punch, punch, punch.
The tribe also hosts weekly classes at the Coeur d'Alene Wellness Center. Several times a week, people gather here on the second floor to dance along to the DVD together. Ryan Ortivez doesn't have a television at home.
I lost 13 and a half pounds.
You lost 13 and a half pounds doing powwow sweat?
Yes. I'm aiming to lose 40 pounds by the end of the year.
Ortivez quit smoking this year. He also gave up junk food and soft drinks.
Get ready!
Wellness Center Director Lavina Louie keeps everyone moving through the various dances. Sometimes she pauses the DVD to workshop the most complicated moves.
We're gonna do jingle!
The jingle dress dance involves a sort of box step. She says it's harder than it looks.
If you don't do it regularly, your calves will hurt. Like you're just out of breath because you're just constantly bouncing. It's almost like jump roping for 25 minutes straight.
We know, for example, that American Indians and Alaska Natives are 60% more likely to be obese than non-Hispanic whites. And so they have real health challenges in their communities.
Dr. Terry O'Toole is with the CDC's Nutrition, Physical Activity, and Obesity Division. Since 1999, the agency has funded requests for community-based health projects. O'Toole's office granted the Coeur d'Alene Tribe $2 million to develop powwow sweat. It also supports a community garden here, an effort to promote indigenous foods, and a project that stocks the reservation's gas station market with healthy food options.
Combating obesity requires more than just one initiative or one program. In fact, it takes a variety of what we call population-based strategies.
The goal, O'Toole says, is to achieve community-wide results. But according to the Coeur d'Alene Tribe's Wellness Center Director, Lavina Louie, that goal isn't easy on a reservation, because mainstream fitness and nutrition programs don't meet the needs of tribal members.
Most programming is only physical or it's only nutrition. It's in these compartments, whereas we're more holistic.
It's that combination of native tradition and exercise that keeps tribal member Ryan Ortivez and his neighbors coming to class each week to watch the DVD and dance alongside each other.
It's a lot more attractive than doing jogging or the bicycle, because it also relates to my culture and my people.
In addition to losing weight and getting healthy, Ortivez wants to be in good enough shape to dance in the tribe's powwow this summer. If he does, it'll be his first time. For NPR News, I'm Emily Schwing on the Coeur d'Alene Reservation.
Now, another issue that comes up during workouts, and this is in all cultures, it is keeping those shoelaces tied. NPR's Rebecca Hersher says there's this new theory about why they come undone and how you can tie your shoes better.
Personally, my shoelaces come untied all the time, like every day. So I identify with this guy.
My shoelaces are chronically coming untied, and this has been happening for probably well over 40 years. I'm Oliver O'Reilly. I'm a professor of mechanical engineering at UC Berkeley.
About a decade ago, O'Reilly started Googling around looking for an explanation for why his shoelaces were coming loose.
I was trying to teach my daughter Anna how to tie her shoelaces.
There were videos of how to tie good knots, but no one seemed to have the answer to why the knots were coming undone in the first place. So he and two graduate students investigated.
My friends essentially went, shoelaces? Really?
Yeah.
I mean, we did all sorts of stuff.
Christine Gregg is one of those grad students. For one experiment, she ran on a treadmill while another researcher pointed a slow-motion camera at her shoes. In another,
we swung our legs back and forth while sitting on tables. We were wandering around the halls of the mechanical engineering building, just staring at our shoes, watching them come untied. So makes you very popular at parties.
We spent a lot of time at parties by ourselves.
Staring at your shoes.
And staring at other people's shoes, going, wow, that's a very interesting knot.
So after all that, the answer to why shoelaces come untied? Imagine you're running. The impact as your foot hits the ground shakes the knot loose with each step, and the swinging of your legs swings the free ends of the laces.
And so you have this interaction between the impact of your foot in the ground that's loosening the knot and the whipping motion that's trying to pull at it and pull it apart.
One interesting thing they found is that catastrophic, fall-on-your-face type shoelace failure kind of happens all at once.
Your lace can be fine for a really long time, but as soon as you get a little bit of loosening, it's all over in about one or two strides.
But you can protect yourself. There are two versions of the common shoelace bow tie knot, and one of them is a lot stronger than the other. It's all about which direction you go in when you get to that final loop in the bow tie. Make sure you go clockwise. It's stronger. You can see photos at NPR.org. Check it out. Why not? Get it? Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
Support for your health comes from Home Instead Senior Care, providing help with bathing, medication reminders, and Alzheimer's and dementia care to keep seniors at home. Homeinstead.com/NPR.
This is NPR News.
David Letterman was a fixture in our late nights for more than three decades. Author Jason Zinnemann says the key to Letterman's charm was his subversion.
At the same time, he was accessible. He seemed like a middle American, relatable guy you might know from down the street.
David Letterman, the last giant of late night and the latest on the crisis in North Korea. On this afternoon's All Things Considered from NPR News.
Letterman plus all today's news from 4 to 6:30 here on Wisconsin Public Radio's All Things Considered. Good morning, it's 8:30. This is Morning Edition on WPR. I'm Maureen McCollum. Still to come this hour, some community-based organizations help low-income people do their taxes, even if they're in the country illegally. More on how and why people who don't even have Social Security numbers file tax returns. That story in about 15 minutes. In Wisconsin news, construction of a long-debated streetcar track is underway in Milwaukee. WUWM-FM reports that welding has begun, and workers will soon start digging trenches for the tracks. The 2.5-mile project has been divisive from the beginning because of its nearly $130 million price tag. More than half the money is coming from the federal government. Five companies have submitted proposals to operate the streetcar so far. A decision is not expected for several months. Milwaukee city engineer says the streetcar team is working closely with downtown businesses to stay ahead of any sort of potential problems. A spokesman for the Milwaukee Public Market says he's not concerned because the market's overall sales grew during construction in a nearby freeway. Officials at Stoughton Trailers say they plan to hire an additional 150 workers over the next few months. The manufacturer makes semi-truck trailers at facilities in Stoughton, Broadhead, and Evansville. The company grew 15% last year and is projected to grow its sales another 15% this year. At its three production plants and its parts and leasing operations, Stoughton Trailers already has about 1,700 workers on payroll. This is WPR News.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the UW Flexible Option, a University of Wisconsin degree and certificate program that adapts to students' busy schedules. More information is at flex.wisconsin.edu.
Support for WGTD comes from Carthage College, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. More information is available online at carthage.edu/grad.
Partly cloudy day today across the state. Highs will be in the lower to mid-50s, except in the lower to mid-40s around Lake Superior. And tonight, partly cloudy still. Temperatures dipping down to the mid to upper 30s, except a little cooler near Lake Superior.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Rackspace, committed to helping companies tame the complexity of the clouds and customized solutions. Rackspace, your clouds, our expertise. Learn more at rackspace.com/expertise. From Optum, committed to tackling the biggest challenges in healthcare with data-driven solutions designed to improve outcomes and make the system better for everyone. Learn more at Optum.com. Optum, how well gets done. And from the Kresge Foundation at Kresge.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green. Let's catch up on a shocking story in Cleveland. Police are hunting for a man they've identified as Steve Stevens. They say he murdered an elderly man and posted video of this killing on Facebook. Annie Wu of member station WCPN IdeaStream is on the line. And Annie, what's the latest on this?
Well, the police still don't know where he is. They say he could be a lot of places, nearby, far away, and they've expanded their search to the Midwest. They said that a woman who was mentioned in the video that he put on Facebook, the woman is cooperating with police, but they declined to identify her or to say where she was.
So they're trying to piece this together, and this is a woman's name who someone said the name on this video?
The man identified by police as Steve Stevens, he he talks about this woman in the video that he posted on Facebook.
Okay, so that's one lead that they're following. And it sounds like, Annie, the police were actually in touch with the suspect pretty shortly after the alleged shooting, the alleged crime. Is that right?
Yes, the investigator spoke to Stevens by cell phone early on and tried to convince him to turn himself in. That obviously did not work.
And remind us here, I mean, this is just extraordinary. He posted this video. It was not live streaming. Police actually think that he filmed this and then posted it onto Facebook afterwards.
Yes, a spokesperson for Facebook says that it was, in fact, uploaded to Facebook. It was not live streamed. But what we do know is that the crime was committed at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Sunday in a Cleveland neighborhood. And the man is 74-year-old Robert Godwin Sr. And the investigation continues, and police are still on the lookout, and they are putting notices up on billboards to try to identify Steve Stevens.
Wow, so still searching for him, and that must have people in Cleveland and surrounding areas a bit nervous. Annie Wu of member station WCPN Idea Stream, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The new chairman of the Democratic Party is about to start a road trip with Bernie Sanders. They want to revitalize a party that's lost the White House and lost Congress. Their itinerary includes swing states like Florida and Nevada and red states like Kentucky, Nebraska, Texas, some more. Tom Perez is on the line to talk about all this. Mr. Chairman, welcome back to the program.
Always good to be with you, Steve.
Do you and Bernie Sanders represent two different wings of the party?
Oh, I think we stand for some basic propositions that all Democrats share, which is America works best when we work for everyone, when we're not just working for a few at the top. We believe that health care is a right, not a privilege. That's why we fought against the repeal of Obamacare. And I think Democrats are at our best when we are united, when we put those values into action, and when we tap into this grassroots energy that's really unprecedented in my lifetime. And that's why we're heading out there across America to talk about this message and to really translate this energy out there into action.
But if we think about Bernie Sanders' approach to Wall Street and, say, the president you served, Barack Obama, his approach to Wall Street, they're a little different, aren't they?
Well, I think what unites us far exceeds what our differences are, and I think we've seen that, Steve, in recent weeks. You know, January 20th was undeniably an important day, but January 21st, in my mind, was far more important.
Oh, the big demonstration the day after the inauguration, right?
Yeah, the demonstrations and the energy that you see out there is really unprecedented in my lifetime. And we see people coming together, whether it's, again, defeating the Affordable Care Act repeal attempts, whether it's making sure we're standing up for fairness. You see Democrats coming together in ways I've not seen before. The energy is palpable. And we need to have a 50-state plus all the territory strategy. Democrats all too frequently, we're not speaking to everyone everywhere. That's what we're doing this week, getting out there, making house calls.
Well, let's talk about that, because you are going to some very, very red states where Democrats keep hoping to do better than they have done. Democrats keep thinking maybe this will be the year for Texas. It hasn't been yet. Kentucky is a state where Democrats used to own the governorship. They don't have it now. What are you going to say differently to red states?
Well, we have to talk to people directly in every state. And frankly, we didn't always do that, Steve. And that's why we're out there in states like Utah and Texas and Kentucky and elsewhere. Because I believe that people in Texas and Kentucky, Utah, they also understand that health care should be a right, not a privilege. They also understand that our economy works best when it works for everyone and not just for a few at the top. And so that's why we're taking this message out there.
Our colleague Scott Detrow is going to be traveling along behind you for part of the trip, and he's in our studios. He's got a question for you.
Yeah, I guess, you know, there was an election in a red state just last week. Democrats made a decision not to put a lot of money into the Kansas House race, and then Democrat James Thompson only just narrowly lost. Was that a mistake?
Well, we invested in the following ways. When people are out there knocking on doors, they were using the DNC's voter file. We were monitoring the election very closely with the state party. We did robocalls at their request. And to me, what's remarkable about that race is that is a beat red district. Republicans usually win by about 30 to 35 points. They won by single digits. If we replicate that success everywhere, we will flip the House in 2018. And we're making tremendous progress. We've already made investments in a race that will take place tomorrow in Georgia. We're investing in races like the Omaha mayor's race. I've said that we need to elect Democrats from the school board to the Senate, and we're working on all types of races because we believe we can elect Democrats because the American people understand that our values are their values.
Will Democrats win in Georgia tomorrow?
Well, I hope so. We're fighting hard, and tomorrow is a jungle primary, so that there's
multiple candidates,
and we hope we can get over 50%, and if not, we'll keep fighting later for the final election. But we have a great set of candidates down there.
Mr. Chairman, thanks very much. Have a nice trip.
Always a pleasure to be with you.
That's Tom Perez, chairman of the Democratic National Committee, who's going to be touring with Bernie Sanders. And Scott Detrow, what do you think about what you just heard?
You know, I think there's certainly a lot of anti-Trump energy in terms of Democratic voters, grassroots activists. The question is, does that become pro-Democrat energy as well? And I think right now that's an open answer. There's a lot of frustration going back to last year with the DNC, with Democrats in Congress, from the people that Perez and other Democrats need to have energized.
Okay, Scott, well, we'll be listening for your reporting as that tour goes forward in the coming days. That's NPR's Scott Detrow.
It is 8:41 on this Monday morning. Hope you had a wonderful weekend. Thanks for starting your weekday here with us on Wisconsin Public Radio. Up next, we'll bring you the latest news from NPR and WPR Live. And in 10 minutes on Morning Edition, the Osage tribe in Oklahoma became spectacularly wealthy in the early 1900s, and then members started turning up dead. Just ahead, we'll hear the author of a new book that looks at this issue in about 10 minutes.
State politics can seem kinda dull, but it does not have to be.
Budget memos, political campaigns.
Even waiting for committees can be kind of fun.
The gang was all there. Like, all the reporters showed up and
I just picture, like,
waiting.
The village people.
Which village person are you, Laurel?
I'm Laurel White.
I'm Sean Johnson.
And I'm John K. Wilson. Join us each week for the WPR Politics Podcast. Find new episodes on iTunes and at WPR.org/politics.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Police in Ohio are describing 37-year-old Steve Stevens as armed and dangerous. They say Stevens shot and killed a 74-year-old man in Cleveland and then uploaded a video of the shooting to Facebook. Police are warning residents of Pennsylvania, New York, Indiana, and Michigan to also be on the lookout for Stevens. Calvin Williams is Cleveland's police chief.
We're asking the public to remain vigilant. We're asking you to go about your day, but to be careful. We're also asking you, if you see anything resembling that vehicle, you have the description of Steve Stevens, to give us a call. Call 911.
That video was on Facebook for 3 hours before it was taken down. Tomorrow is the deadline to file federal income tax returns in the U.S. Julie Rovner with Kaiser Health News says those who received a tax credit for health care in 2016 should take note.
If you got one of them, then you have to fill out a very complicated separate form to see if the tax credits you got from the government were too much or too little or just the right amount. Last year, more people ended up having to pay back tax credits than got additional money, although in most cases, even those who had to pay back tax credits, meaning they got too much, still got a refund overall on their taxes.
Stocks are higher on Wall Street in early trading. The Dow is up 62 points. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:43. I'm Maureen McCollum. A new study shows trout fishing brought in $1.6 billion to local economies in the driftless area of Wisconsin and to neighboring states last year. As Hope Kerwin reports, the survey shows anglers came for the fish but sent their money on a lot more.
The average angler spends almost $500 during a trout fishing trip to southwestern Wisconsin. The survey of individuals who bought trout fishing permits in 2016 also found fishing tourists make an average of 6 trips to the Driftless area every year. Jeff Hastings with Trout Unlimited says that steady stream of business can have a big impact on local businesses.
We see hotel signs that says, you know, welcome trout fishermen. We hear from our restaurants that, you know, they see a number of our chapters coming into Friday Night Fish Fries.
Direct visitor spending was over $400 million last year, and the larger indirect economic impacts on local farms and supply chains was over $600 million. Hope Curran, Wisconsin Public Radio.
A service will be held this evening in Sparta to honor the state trooper killed in a traffic crash while on duty. Officials say 34-year-old Anthony Borostowski of Toma might have been catching up with an offending motorist last week when his patrol car veered into a ditch and struck a tree on I-90/94 near the Wisconsin Dells. He'll be remembered at 5 this evening at Sparta High School, with visitations beginning at noon. Full police and military honors will follow the service in the school's parking lot. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the law firm Cooley LLP. With offices in the U.S., Europe, and China, Cooley advises entrepreneurs, investors, financial institutions, and established companies around the world, where innovation meets the law. From Stitch Fix, an online personal styling service for women and men, clients fill out a style quiz, then a personal stylist sends hand-picked pieces straight to their door. Learn more at stitchfix.com. And from the Kresge Foundation at kresge.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green. Millions of taxpayers are rushing to complete their federal and state filings before the tax deadline tomorrow. And among them are several million people in this country illegally. But as NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports, tax preparers are seeing signs that fewer immigrants may be filing this year than in years past.
There's a common belief that immigrants in this country without authorization don't file or pay taxes. But the IRS says that in 2015, nearly 4.5 million people across the country who don't have Social Security numbers filed federal tax returns, and many are in this country illegally.
Unity Council, how can I help you?
The Unity Council is an East Oakland community-based organization offering free tax preparation for low-income people. On a recent afternoon, about a dozen clients and IRS-certified volunteer tax preparers are hunched over rows of aging computers. Clarissa Johnson directs this clinic.
We'll help everyone. We don't ask them about their immigration status. That is between them and the tax preparer.
Many of these people use individual taxpayer identification numbers, or ITINs. Some ITIN holders are foreign investors or students, but it's generally understood that most tax filers using an ITIN are in this country illegally. Like 36-year-old Axel, who asked that we not use his last name because of his immigration status. He came to the United States from Guatemala several years ago, and he says he has no hesitation about filing his tax returns.
Primero porque es mi responsabilidad.
First, because it's my responsibility, he says, and I want to do things the correct way. Axel says a few years ago, a shady tax preparer made mistakes on his return, and he wound up getting fined several $1,000s.
No me gusta meterme a problemas.
I don't like to create problems for myself, he says. There's an obvious incentive to file, a chance to get a refund. The Unity Council's Clarissa Johnson says another reason is if a person winds up in immigration court, a record of having filed taxes is considered evidence of good moral character.
And especially if they're working toward their citizenship, it's something that can show that they're here for the long haul.
According to the Taxpayer Advocate Service, an office of the IRS, ITIN filers last year paid almost $24 billion in federal taxes. Yet as the Trump administration cracks down on illegal immigration, there's some anecdotal evidence that fewer immigrants using ITINs are choosing to file their taxes this year. Max Moy Borgen runs the tax program at the Mission Economic Development Agency in San Francisco. It's one of the largest free tax preparation programs in the country.
Many of our clients are telling us that in years past, they felt more hope and more of ability to have a pathway towards citizenship. And lately, there's a lot less hope.
Overall, tax service providers in the San Francisco Bay Area say there's about a 20% decline in the number of people filing with ITINs. There are similar reports from service providers in other areas of the country, says Francine Lippman. She teaches tax law at the University of Nevada.
Sending in a tax return with your current address and information is very unnerving to a population that wants to comply with the law and is actually leaving significant refunds on the table by not filing tax returns.
Still, the IRS is barred from sharing its information with other government agencies, such as the Department of Homeland Security, except under limited circumstances. But Lippman says many ITIN filers have to decide whether to trust that firewall. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News, San Francisco.
This is NPR News.
It's 10 minutes before 9 o'clock on this Monday morning. Thanks for starting your day with us here on Wisconsin Public Radio. The music starts in 15 minutes, and today's highlights include excerpts from two ballets, The Nutcracker and Mother Goose. There's also a guest from Madison Opera on the midday and a waltz by Scott Joplin. Join Stephanie Elkins for Morning Classics right after the headlines at 9. And stay tuned. There's more from Morning Edition next here on WPR.
WGTD broadcasts from studios located on the Kenosha campus of Gateway Technical College. In Kenosha and Racine, WGTD is heard at 91.1 FM, Elkhorn at 101.7, Lake Geneva 103.3, and around the world at WGTD.org.
The cast of regulars will be on hand, as well as some Wisconsin surprises. That Says You, Saturday, May 6th at the Lismore in downtown Eau Claire, beginning at 7. Tickets are available at WPR.org/100.
Should be a cloudy day across the state, partly cloudy, that is. Highs will be in the lower to mid-50s and in the lower to mid-40s near Lake Superior. Tonight, partly cloudy still, with temperatures dipping down to the mid to upper 30s, except in the lower 30s around Lake Superior.
Support for WPR comes from CTM with To the Promised Land. A young African-American girl and Golda Meir share hope and strength in this locally written play, April 22nd through the 30th. Tickets are at ctmtheater.org.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, Parkside Wind Ensemble and Community Band present a concert on Thursday, April 20th at 7:30 p.m. in the Rita Center for the Arts, featuring a solo performance by Professor James McKeever. Tickets are $10 for adults and $5 for students and seniors.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Generations ago, the Osage Indian Nation was forced to move. Not for the first time, white settlers pushed them off their land in the 1800s. The writer David Grand sees in that move the start of an astonishing and tragic story.
When they were being driven off their land in Kansas, they didn't know where to go. And an Osage chief stood up and he said, we should go to this area that would later become Northeast Oklahoma because it's rocky and infertile and the white man will finally leave us alone.
It turned out the Osage had chosen land that was rich in oil. In the early 20th century, members of this beaten-down Indian nation grew spectacularly wealthy. They bought cars. They built mansions. They made so much oil money that the government began appointing white guardians to help the Indians spend it. And then the Osage started to be killed. David Grand investigated their story for the new book, Killers of the Flower Moon. He tells this half-forgotten story beginning with Molly Burkhart, an Osage woman, in 1921. What happened to her?
So Molly Burkhart's family, she had four sisters, and one day in 1921, her older sister disappeared, and about a week later, her body was found in a ravine. Molly's mother, within 2 months, she too had died, and evidence later suggested that she had been secretly poisoned. Not long after that, Molly was sleeping in her bed. She heard a loud explosion, and she had another sister who lived not far away. And in the area where her sister's house was, she could see almost this orange fireball rising into the sky. And her sister's house had been blown up, killing that sister as well as her sister's husband and a servant.
It's still a little hard to get your brain around how it is that someone could commit all these killings and then inherit their oil wealth. Who would be in a position to do that?
What makes these crimes so sinister is that it involved marrying into families. It involved a level of calculation and a level of betraying the very people you pretended to love.
You mentioned Molly Burkhart.
That's exactly what happened to Molly. She had married a white man, and his uncle was the most powerful settler in the area. He was known as the King of the Osage Hills, and he had orchestrated a very sinister plot played out over years where he directed his nephew, who had married Molly Burkhart, to marry her so that he could then begin to kill the family members one by one and siphon off all the wealth.
How was this series of crimes investigated?
So it's really important to understand back then that there was so much lawlessness. That was one of the things that shocked me when I began researching the story, that even in the 1920s, much of America remained a country that was not fully rooted in its laws. Its legal institutions were very fragile. Molly Burkhart beseeched the authorities to try to investigate, to get help, but because of prejudice, they often ignored the crimes. And almost anyone who tried to investigate the killings, they too were killed. One attorney tried to gather evidence, and one day he was thrown off a speeding train, and all the evidence that he had gathered had disappeared. Another time, an oilman had traveled to Washington, D.C. to try to get help. He was then found stabbed more than 20 times. And finally, a very obscure branch of the Justice Department intervened. It was known as the Bureau of Investigation, and it was what would later be renamed the FBI.
J. Edgar Hoover.
J. Edgar Hoover. He was the new director, and it became one of the FBI's first major homicide cases that it ever dealt with.
Did the agency that became the FBI solve these murders?
The Bureau initially badly bungled the case, and J. Edgar Hoover was new in the job, and he was very insecure. He had dreams about building a bureaucratic empire, and he turned the case over to a frontier lawman who put together an undercover team that included one of probably the only American Indian agent in the Bureau at the time. They were able, through some dogged investigation, to eventually capture some of the ringleaders.
Are you telling me that the future Federal Bureau of Investigation established its reputation as great investigators by subcontracting it out to somebody who actually knew what they were doing?
He did. They went to an old frontier lawman to help take over the case, and they did a good job. But Hoover was desperate to wrap up the case. The Bureau missed a deeper and darker conspiracy that remained unsolved, and I think that's very important to understand.
How do you know that?
Well, many of the Osage began to point me in directions to other unsolved cases within their families going back. What this story really is about, it's not about a story of who did it. It's a story about who didn't do it. When I went to the National Archives in Texas, there was this little booklet. It had a little fabric cover. All it was essentially identifying the name of a guardian and which Osage they were in charge of. And when I began to look at the names of the Osage under them, I could see written next to many of them simply the word dead, dead, dead. You're beginning to realize you're looking at hints of a systematic murder campaign, because there is no way all these people died in a span of just a couple years. It defied any natural death rate. And then when you begin to look into each of those individual cases, you start to find trails of evidence of suggesting poisonings or murder. You start to try to trace the money and where the wealth went. What you begin to discover is something even more horrifying than the Bureau ever exposed.
When you've been poking around in this and revealing this information about a bunch of people's ancestors, what have people said to you?
So one of the things that you realize when you spend time in Osage County is that the descendants of both the victims and descendants of the murderers still live there. They often live down the street from each other. And one Osage woman told me, we try not to hold them accountable for what their ancestors did. Part of that is the story of America, this intertwining and this kind of reckoning with this original sin that is part of our formation of a country. And I would say this, I spoke with some of the descendants of the husband of Molly Burkhart, mm-hmm. and the uncle, who was one of the masterminds of the plot. And they were remarkably candid. And after I finished the book, I received a note from one of the descendants who said, "I'm so ashamed that this is part of our history, and please, if you see the Osage, will you please tell them that?"
David Gran is author of the new book, Killers of the Flower Moon, The Osage Murders and the Birth of the FBI. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green.
And you can hear Morning Edition from 5 until 9 every weekday. And if you missed something, try streaming it with the WPR app. There are headlines right around the corner and stories at WPR.org, including one this morning about solitary confinement in Wisconsin prisons.
Support for WPR comes from the UW Health Breast Center, where all biopsies are reviewed by a team of cancer pathologists to determine an appropriate treatment plan. In healthcare, experience matters. UWHealth.org/second opinion.
Support for WGTD comes from the Walworth Business Expo and Job Fair at Grand Geneva, April 25th from 9 to noon. Network with other business people or job search. From WCEDA, Walworth County Economic Development Alliance, information at walworthcountybusiness.com.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha.